Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a former colleague of the U.S. ambassador in Libya who was killed along with three other Americans in an attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi. Wayne White, who was the former deputy director of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research's Office of Analysis and State Department's former intelligence analyst on Libya, joins us. Then we'll look into the latest examples of ignorant Islamophobia that sparked the riots at the U.S. Embassy in Cairo and the consulate in Benghazi that led to the deaths of the four Americans. Nathan Lean, the author of a new book, The Islamophobia Industry, How the Right Manufactures Fear of Muslims, joins us to discuss the irresponsible hate speech generated by Islamophobes, such as this latest $5 million film by LA-based Israeli real estate developer, which opened to empty theaters, yet managed to provoke the killings of Americans. Then finally, we will speak with Kurt Eichenwald, the author of a new book, 500 Days, Secrets and Lies in the Terror Wars. We will discuss the explosive evidence he has uncovered from about the reckless dismissal of alarming evidence of the impending 9/11 attack that the Bush administration ignored and the serial blunders that followed in the tragically misconceived and misdirected war on terror. Joining us now is Wayne White, who's a scholar at the Middle East Institute, specializing in a number of Middle East countries, including Iran and Iraq. He is a policy expert at the Middle East Policy Council and an expert advisor to the Iraq Study Group. He previously served as Deputy Director of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research's Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia, and served as a State Department intelligence analyst on Libya. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wayne White.
Hi, Ian. How are you?
Well, I'm okay. I understand you're not feeling particularly good, Wayne, given that your colleague, U.S. Ambassador to Libya, Christopher Stevens, died yesterday on September the 11th, along with the two Marines and a Foreign Service officer, Sean Smith.
I know. I woke up this morning, as usual, early, around 5:50. I turn on the news, and as my first thing I always do, and I'm immediately going into a state of shock over the lead story on the news. I was just floored.
So tell me about your colleague, Christopher Stevens. What was he like?
Oh, he might have been among the nicest people I ever met in the State Department. And I had most of my dealings with him back in the 1990s when he was moving up, you know, in the Foreign Service, and he was on the Iran desk, and he was the staff assistant to our Assistant Secretary for Near Eastern Affairs, and so those were in the policy parts of the State Department. We were the intelligence side, and during the 90s, I was the division chief for Iran, Iraq, the Persian Gulf, and the whole North African area, and so he would come over with things that were needed from that side and plop himself down on my couch. And you know, even if he was bringing something we really didn't want to see, you know, because it was near closing time and some urgent, you know, request was coming my way, just seeing Chris's, that smile you see on TV that's now so sad in the context of today's events, he just light up the room and just make it all seemed like it was okay. He was very, very spontaneous and generous, and I never saw him do a nasty or mean thing to anyone the whole time, you know, he was working with us or interacting.
So it looks as though there's a connection here with his death, and we know about the riots that took place in Cairo and in Benghazi, but they really weren't that significant. And we know it's had political repercussions here because of the somewhat inexplicable comments made by Mitt Romney, which we can certainly discuss. But it's looking more and more like Ayman al-Zawahiri was involved in as much as he's been seeking revenge for the killing back in June by a drone in Pakistan of his the number two, I think, in al-Qaeda, although who knows what numbers they are. But this fellow al-Libi, who was killed, Libyan, obviously. And What's your sense of this somewhat lawless part of Libya? They've just had a civil war, and apparently there are these camps out in the desert that U.S. drones have been looking at.
Well, you hit it right on the nose when you said a particularly lawless part of Libya. Another one is the southern desert regions below Tripoli, mountain towns and desert towns where there are militias that haven't been disarmed and even fight each other. The government has not been able to establish central authority, even following July parliamentary elections, which were a surprising and thumping reverse for Islamic militants. The Libyans, seeing what happened in Cairo with the burgeoning power of the Muslim Brotherhood and knowing all what all the West had done for them, thumpingly rejected the notion of an Islamist state in Libya, which is one of those occurrences you look for people who come out that are often the silent majority of moderates and reject that vision. But still, the central government has had a lot of trouble regaining order because, for one thing, there's so many guns in the country from Gaddafi's looted arsenals in particular. And in the east, we have a particular problem, and that is that even under Gaddafi, there was a hardline strain of Islam that was, during the 90s especially, conducting essentially an insurgency against the Gaddafi regime based on radical Islam and taking down government targets and police targets and what have you. And it was put down in the end. But a lot of the ones that were involved in it streamed off out of Libya after the defeat into Afghanistan and became affiliated with Al-Qaeda. And many of them died, you know, in the 2001-2002 U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, but there were enough left to filter back into Libya after the fact, keep a low profile, and then, you know, rise and become parts of militias today. So it is an area of the country where there is a tradition of Islamist, you know, sentiment, of intense Islamist sentiment. It's also a region that collectively somewhat resents being ruled from the capital, Tripoli, which is 800 miles to the west and is a different sub-region of the country. So there are a lot of tensions over there, even though for a while that was the place that stood alone against Gaddafi and until the civil war spread wider.
So, Wayne White, the spark, of course, for the street demonstrations, both in Cairo and in Benghazi, was this Islamophobic movie, which nobody's ever seen, made by an Israeli here in Los Angeles, who's apparently a real estate developer. He raised $5 million. It's hard to believe he spent that on the film. Apparently they played they put a trailer with an Egyptian-voiced Arabic dub on it up on YouTube.
Well, been having trouble even verifying all that.
Yeah.
In fact, there have been accusations that some Egyptian Christian cops, Coptic Christians, who were bitter over the treatment that some of them received during the Egyptian revolution against Mubarak, helped fund, you know, this particular thing. It's a little bit
right.
Murky.
It is murky, but the long and short of it is obscure and somewhat ignorant people like that pastor down in Florida can provoke acts that end up killing American servicemen and diplomats.
Absolutely, and then, of course, disavow all responsibility for having anything to do with it.
Right. So, but you know, we have to hold our political leaders responsible, and I'm just astounded at what Romney said. First of all, he condemned the U.S., the embassy in Cairo put out an apology and disavowed this terrible film before they scaled the walls. They were obviously trying to quieten things down. And Romney's gone on the record saying that the Obama administration is apologizing to terrorists, and he's now.
Well, the statement I saw, I don't think it was in paraphrase either. Early this morning, said that he actually included language saying that the Obama administration supported these elements, and with it remaining unclear as to who he was talking about. Like, we supported the militants in the Muslim Brotherhood who commit these kinds of acts? I hardly think so, just the opposite. And so if that was in the statement, which I saw very early this morning, that's just very inflammatory in the reverse direction, accusing the administration of affiliating itself with forces that are anathema to any responsible American administration.
Well, I don't.
You're very correct in saying that the timeline is something that's being blurred by a lot of people in the Romney camp to obscure the fact that this statement came out of the embassy before there was a complete out-of-control riot that went over the walls and tore down the American flag, as if to suggest that that statement approved of that or did not defend, you know, or address that, which it wouldn't have since it didn't happen yet.
Well, there's another accusation out, too, that that's being pushed by the Romney camp, and that is that somehow the White House has slighted Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel. And I've spoken to a number of people about, you know, he's trying to force the White House to come up with to publicly announce a red line over an attack on Iran. The Israeli press, of course, is full of speculation that an attack is pending. I spoke recently with Colonel Wilkerson, Colin Powell's former chief of staff, mm-hmm. and he said that there is a belief that perhaps the Netanyahu administration has recognized that Obama will win and that they will launch an attack on Iran just before the elections to give Obama a bump and then essentially own him and force him into owning their policy. And you've written something somewhat different, suggesting that if Romney were to win, you made the analogy with what happened in the lame duck period after George W. Bush's second term before Obama came in, where Netanyahu attacked Gaza and then wrapped it up the day before Obama's inauguration. So walk us through that scenario, if you will.
It's very dicey, and I think one thing that needs to be said here, despite what Netanyahu implied a lack of support and what the, you know, certain people critical of the president have asserted that this is some kind of low point in American support for Israel. Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak said that this was one of the highest levels of American Israeli cooperation, referring to the recent years, during which a missile shield system that Israel's trying to stand up in case Hezbollah fires off missiles, or waves of missiles against them, called Iron Dome, is being put in place, and we're supporting that fully. It contradicts even the most critical Israeli official dealing with national defense, and should a war be launched, a lot of what we're hearing out of Israel is that it would be the prime minister overruling many of his own senior military officers who have consistently opposed a strike against Iran. And so these are all major considerations when people start asserting that, all of Israel or the Israelis feel a certain way, or that the U.S. relationship with Israel is in some kind of very serious trouble. It has been very close. I happen to know that from sources like Larry Wilkinson, has gotten access to. Another thing about these scenarios, one scenario, yes, I'm worried about, and we put it in a Middle East Institute consensus paper on the whole Iran nuclear issue as sort of a wild card, is that if Romney wins, knowing fully that despite what Romney says on the campaign stump, that he would probably be very upset to have a war in the Gulf dumped on in his lap as a new president, that it might occur during the interregnum while President Obama is a lame duck and Romney would be waiting to come to office, very much like what we discussed about the Gaza campaign the next time, knowing that regardless of Romney's views, he would be very, very dismayed to inherit this mess and would try to do it before Romney took office.
So, in a way, even though the tragedy that happened in Libya that has led to the deployment of some warships and marines and drones heading towards Libya, the real eye should be on what's going on in between Israel and Iran. Is that in summary and in closing? Is that your belief?
In a strategic way, yes, but we've still got to look very carefully in the next days and couple weeks over possible blow-ups in other countries related to this film. And one country that I worry about doesn't seem to be on a lot of people's radar screens, strangely, because they're looking at Tunisia and watching that there have been demonstrations in Morocco, is Pakistan.
Oh, well, that's a
country can be very explosive as far as street violence, and I'm sure that the administration has put out the alarm, and to the Pakistani government, which does have a good police organization, which it can use, and go on with the army to ring American facilities, a very disciplined force. And so, let's hope that we don't see something explode there.
Well, Wayne White, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Wayne White, who's a scholar at the Middle East Institute, and he is a policy expert at the Middle East Policy Council and was an expert advisor to the Iraq Study Group. He previously served as Deputy Director of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research's Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia, and also served as a State Department Intelligence Analyst on Libya. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the Islamophobia industry.
Time we see these acts against humanity. While each for each and each world leader shed blood for what they each believe. On and on and on we go. Well, some will you see, some won't be. Truth for you and truth will lead you to a sense of heart. Well, now.
Oh, my name, it ain't nothing. My age, it means less. The country I come from is called the Midwest. I was taught and brought up there the laws to abide, and that the land that I live in has God on its side.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Nathan Lean, who is the editor-in-chief of Aslan Media and a contributing writer at the Huffington Post. He is the co-author of Iran, Israel, and the United States. And his latest book just out is The Islamophobic Industry, How the Right Manufactures Fear of Muslims. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nathan Lean.
Thank you for having me.
Now, this whole tragedy that involved the killing of four Americans, including the U.S. ambassador, in Benghazi, Libya, along with the attack on the U.S. Embassy in Cairo, appears to have been sparked by an obscure Israeli filmmaker here in Los Angeles. His name is Sam Basili, who supposedly spent $5 million on making this two-hour movie that opened to empty theaters here in Los Angeles and hasn't been seen anywhere else. But apparently the trailer of the film, which was dubbed into Arabic with an Egyptian accent, managed to make its way through YouTube and to spark this revolt. And it sort of reminds me of that ignorant preacher down in Florida who was going to burn the Korans, even though the U.S. military were begging him not to do it because it would have the direct effect of killing Americans. So what's driving these people who are so irresponsibly placing the lives of Americans in danger in order to propagate their poison?
Well, what's really driving them is the fact that they are all really a part of the Islamophobia industry, as I call it. This is what these people do. I mean, the fact of the matter is, Kerry Jones, the Florida pastor whom you just mentioned, isn't really someone who's very known, apart from the fact that he uses these political stunts to sort of draw attention to himself. So, you know, Tuesday's film controversy came, you know, at a convenient time for him. It came at a time where he also planned to, you know, put the Prophet Muhammad and the religion of Islam on trial, right? So he, you know, I hate to use the term prostitution, but that's really what's happening here. This is a simple simple matter of media prostitution for many of these people. They realize that they can tap into growing anti-Muslim sentiment, that they can, you know, spread outrageous videos or engage in just outrageous acts that most ordinary Americans would find repulsive, but nonetheless attract a steady band of sort of right-wing followers who frequent, you know, Islamophobic websites and who, you know, propagate this type of sentiment.
Well, apparently this film, and it's hard to believe that it cost $5 million. I think probably the Sam Basili guy pocketed most of it, which was raised from members of the Israeli Jewish community here in Los Angeles, apparently. He's a local real estate developer. No shortage of them out here. Apparently it has incredibly wooden dialogue and is full of insults disguised as revelations about who Muhammad was, and his followers are portrayed as a sort of bunch of goons, and Muhammad is portrayed as a philanderer who is all in favor of child sex abuse, etc. I mean, it sounds like they really went out of their way to be provocative, and we know what happened with the Danish cartoons, and we know what happened with the threats to burn the Quran, and we know what happened when the U.S. military destroyed some Qurans. I mean, I just don't understand. I guess, you know, nobody's saying we should have censorship in this country, but I just can't believe that ignorant people are able to wreak such havoc and without consequences to them.
Yes,
I mean,
yes,
you know.
No, that's absolutely right. Look, one of the film's consultants mentioned, you know, just in an interview within the past, I guess, the past day, that he knew that the film would provoke this type of, you know, violent response in the Middle East. So, you know, before news of, you know, what had happened in Libya and in Cairo and in Gaza and the protests that have sort of popped up across the Middle East ever reached the television screens or the radio stations of, you know, Americans, this individual knew that this was going to happen. So it was part of an obvious plan. And, you know, people like this, whether they're Kerry Jones or whether they're, you know, sort of obscure, you know, California-based real estate agents or property developers or whatever, you know, that they're looking to provoke in the most outrageous way possible. You know, another great example of this is the, you know, professional anti-Muslim blogger Robert Spencer, who is a central part of this Islamophobia industry. Robert Spencer even went so far as to publish a book, which is his latest book, questioning whether the Prophet Muhammad existed at all. So here you have an individual that's not only attacking Muslims and attacking the religion of Islam on a daily basis, but is now questioning whether the religion's prophet ever existed. I mean, this is some of the most outrageous stuff I've ever heard of. And, you know, while these individuals do have a right to say these things, and while they are certainly protected by the Constitution and free speech laws, they must realize that their language and the narratives that they advance have real consequences. And, you know, I think there's a very fine line between hate speech and free speech. And we have to sort of decide as a society what we want to do to sort of combat these episodes of violence that pop up when people antagonize individuals over a long period of time and lead them sort of towards these, these provocations and these clashes.
Well, yeah, but one thing that seems to be consistent throughout this is that you've got Terry Jones, who's just a total ignoramus, the pastor down in Florida. You have this redneck idiot who shot a bunch of Sikhs at a temple recently because he thought they were Muslims. And in his case, and in the case of that crazy Norwegian guy who killed 80-something kids at an island, he said that in his manifestos that Spencer had inspired him, along with this horrible woman, Pamela Geller, you know, who's just complete... I mean, she drove her husband to an early grave and she tried to rob her own children's trust funds in order to get more plastic surgery and toy boys. I mean, these people are lowlifes.
Well, they really are. You know, the thing about Spencer is, yes, you know, this is a point that I think is important and needs to be repeated over and over again. The Norway killer, Anders Breivik, did mention Spencer, but it wasn't one or two or three or four or five mentions even. Breivik cited Robert Spencer's writings 162 times in his manifesto, and he said of Robert Spencer, and I'm quoting him, quote, "About Islam, I would recommend essentially everything written by Robert Spencer," end quote. The sad thing is, I think until we as a society come to view Islamophobia in the same light as we now view racism and anti-Semitism, not much will be done. When we can agree that, anti-Muslim sentiment, prejudicing and stereotyping Muslims is just as awful and as dangerous as making the same types of comments about, for instance, African Americans or Jews or other minority groups that have been attacked and antagonized in our history, we're not going to see much change. My hope is that the word Islamophobia will become a regular part of our discourse, because the thing is, if you can't name it, it doesn't exist. And the reality is, not enough people use the term Islamophobia because not enough people have come to the conclusion in their own minds that anti-Muslim sentiment is a real social cancer and is tearing apart this country and the world just as past prejudices have.
Well, probably the only thing more despicable to my mind than these Terry Jones and Pamela Gellers and company and this idiot Israeli alleged filmmaker out here in California, the only thing worse to my mind are these opportunistic politicians who whip up this hysteria and invent this nemesis with passing anti-Sharia laws, etc. And frankly, Mitt Romney has not distinguished himself in his response to the attacks on the U.S. embassy. He blamed the State Department for being soft on terrorists or the Obama administration, simply because they issued a statement how appalled they were at this horrible film that provoked the demonstrations. And this was before they attacked the embassy. And then he's since doubled down on his attacks. So is Romney reaching out to the Islamophobes?
Romney is absolutely saying these types of things for a very clear reason, and that is that Islamophobia exists on the right side of the political spectrum. There was a wonderful article written a week or so ago on the Huffington Post that discussed this. It said, not all Republicans are Islamophobes, but all Islamophobes are Republicans. That was sort of a play on the not all Muslims are terrorists, but all terrorists are Muslims, meme that sort of spun out of control. The reality of it is Romney, by criticizing the State Department in his initial response to the violence in Libya, by refusing to sort of take a firm stance against, hate speech and the provocation that led to a lot of these protests, is speaking directly to his base. I mean, here we are in 2000 and 2012, September 2012, just a couple of months before the election, and 52% of Republican voters in Mississippi and Alabama still believe that the President of the United States is a Muslim. Not only do they believe that he's a Muslim, but they presuppose that that's a bad thing. That number is shocking enough, but what's even more shocking than that is that 17% of Republican voters overall believe that Barack Obama is still a Muslim. So, you know, the reality is, in order for, you know, Mitt Romney to sort of speak to every group, you know, on the right side of the political spectrum, he's got to be careful. He can't come out of a gate, you know, saying anything that would turn off a particular faction of the political right to his candidacy.
Well, just in closing, Nathan Lean, is there any funding behind the Islamophobia? In other words, are there people behind the scenes stirring the pot?
Absolutely, there are people behind the scenes stirring the pot. I mean, you know, CAP, the Center for American Progress, released a wonderful report last year called Fear, Inc. And what this report essentially did was it followed, after a six-month-long investigation, $42 million that had come from seven different foundations. You know, these foundations included the Donors Capital Fund, the Lynn and Harry Bradley Foundation, Fairbrook. These organizations, over the course of 10 years, had given more than $42 million to people like David Horowitz, the individual who funds Robert Spencer, to Steve Emerson's investigative project on terrorism, to the Clarion Fund, the front group for the radical right-wing Zionist organization in the occupied territories that promoted the anti-Muslim film Obsession, which was released just before the elections in 2008. So there is a lot of money that is funneled into these groups. And in addition to the $42 million, you have, unfortunately, I'm sad to say, many ordinary Americans that buy into these narratives of hate, visit the websites of people like Geller and Spencer, and click on a PayPal link, delivering them more money and more fuel to continue with their hate speech. The latest sort of manifestation of that are the racist bus ads that they ran in San Francisco and in New York City, equating the Palestinian cause to holy war and jihad, saying that it was a battle between civilization and savagery. This is how these people operate. This is how they get their money, and they are slowly tearing apart the pluralistic fabric of the United States and the world.
Yeah, and this movie by Dinesh D'Souza, which is a hit job on Obama, is doing well at the box office, and clearly there's quite a juggernaut here that you've written about in your new book, The Islamophobic Industry, How the Right Manufactures Fear of Muslims. I thank you for joining us, Nathan Lean.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Nathan Lean, the editor-in-chief of Aslan Media and a contributing writer at the Huffington Post. He's the co-author of Iran, Israel, and the United States, and his latest book just out is The Islamophobia Industry, How the Right Manufactures Fear of Muslims. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with Kurt Eichenwald, who has uncovered an enormous amount of secret CIA briefs indicating the reckless endangerment of the United States by the Bush administration in ignoring repeated warnings of the impending 9/11 attack.
Thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Kurt Eichenwald, who is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and a New York Times bestselling author. He previously worked as a reporter at the New York Times for more than 20 years and is a two-time winner of the George Polk Award for Excellence in Journalism and was a Pulitzer Prize finalist in 2000 and 2002. His second book, The Informant, was made into a major motion picture starring Matt Damon. And his latest book just out is 500 Days, Secrets and Lies in the Terror Wars. And here's an article at the New York Times, The Deafness Before the Storm. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kurt Eichenwald.
Thanks for having me.
And just to touch on your article, I spoke yesterday with a FBI special agent who tried to warn about the impending terror attack before 9/11 involving Zacharias Moussaoui in Minnesota. She testified before the Senate about lapses in intelligence prior to 9/11. But your article has brought to light stuff that's extremely necessary, and it's extraordinary that 11 years after it, we still don't know the full picture. And of course, in the absence of having the full picture of what happened prior to 9/11, the conspiracy theorists have filled the void to some extent. So could you walk us through some of these extraordinary briefs and memos that you uncovered from the CIA that were prior to the famous or infamous August the 6th brief titled Bin Laden Determined to Strike in the U.S.?
Well, to understand all this, you actually have to start with the August 6th, what's called the Presidential Daily Brief. And it's the thing that's presented to the president, and they go over it, you know, every day, as it's named. That document was the sole document that was released by the Bush White House in 2004 when they were being pressured by the 9/11 Commission to let the public see what the president was told and when. This was the only one. And when it was released, Condoleezza Rice, who at that time I believe was the National Security Advisor, or she may have already passed over to being Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice said, well, this is just a historical document. If we had allegations of an actual threat, we would have done something, but this was just a historical document. Some people belittled that, but when you read it, it really was a historical document. It was a backgrounder on bin Laden and al-Qaeda. And it was also a red herring, because I have now seen all the other presidential daily briefs that were not released. And these were things that were presented to George Bush beginning in the late spring of 2001. And in truth, when you look at the August 6th memo in and of itself, yes, it's a historical document. When you look at it in the context of everything else that was going on, it was a plea. It was a plea by the intelligence community saying, please do something. They started on May 1st of 2001, there was a presidential daily briefing where George Bush was told that there was a group of terrorists in the United States, a group of al-Qaeda terrorists in the United States who were planning an operation. In the months that followed, weeks and months that followed, he was told that there were going to be mass casualties, that this had been underway for some time, that they first expected it to be in July, that it had been postponed and was going to be coming later, but it was still in operation. In July, they said it's weeks, it's months, possibly weeks away. And it was this drumbeat of there is an attack coming. The reaction was so limited that by July 9th, members of the Counterterrorist Center at the CIA were having a meeting in the basement of the CIA headquarters, and one of them said, we need to put in for a mass transfer because this thing is coming, it's going to be really bad, nobody's going to do anything to stop it, and we're going to be the ones who are blamed. And the senior officer in the room said, there's nobody who can take our place right now. We're the most qualified people to ride this thing down. So it gives you a sense of how both the magnitude of what the White House was being told and the frustration on the part of the people who were telling it, And then, you know, the postscript to all this is after 9/11 happened and there were challenges to the Bush administration about, you know, why didn't you do something, their response was, well, the CIA didn't give us enough information. And that, you know, among all of the crimes of 9/11, you know, that was one of them, to basically attack the people who were right, knowing that they couldn't respond.
Again, I'm speaking with Kirk Eichenwald, who is the author of the new book just out, 500 Days, Secrets and Lies in the Terror Wars, and he also has an article at the New York Times, The Deafness Before the Storm. Now, since I spoke with Colleen Rowley yesterday, I've got a blizzard of mail from 9/11 truthers, and every time you present real evidence about the incredible, irresponsible recklessness of the Bush administration in recklessly endangering the United States and ignoring these extraordinary warnings that you've uncovered from CIA briefs, that only feeds into that delusion that somehow, you know, these geniuses, Bush and Cheney and Rice, managed to convince a bunch of Arabs to fly into a building, into a bunch of buildings in order to rescue their failed presidency, when in fact the real story is that these leaders should be pilloried for what they failed to do. That was their responsibility. And to some extent, to my mind, the 9/11 truthers are the Bush cover-up.
The truthers are despicable, and, you know, they really need to go get a life. You know, the truthers are the left's version of the birthers, and they're just as reasonable and just as logical. And my hope is that someday they just all go away, because they make it virtually impossible for those of us who are actually, you know, interested in figuring out what the real history is to lay it out. I mean, you know, a big example of this, I write about these documents. I write, here is what Bush says. And immediately yesterday, Ari Fleischer, the former spokesman for the White House spokesman, comes out and says, well, Eichenwald's just a 9/11 truther, you know, and that becomes the theme of the conservative Twitterati who, rather than say, let's look at history, wow, here's another element of history, see everything through a political lens. It makes it very difficult to do history when there are people out there who are doing delusion.
Well, again, they, to my mind, they really operate as the cover-up team for George W. Bush. And I'm grateful that you've been able to put some stuff on the record about what Bush, Cheney, and Rice and company are really concerned about, is that the American people focusing in on how badly they screwed up and how culpable they are for this attack.
It's, you know, one of the things that people will sometimes conclude, and I want to make sure I say this, is that, well, here they had this information and all they had to do was X and 9/11 wouldn't have happened. Even if they acted on it, it's not clear that 9/11 wouldn't have happened. I mean, there was a precedent for what they should have done. You know, the same type of hair-on-fire kind of intelligence was coming in December of 1999, and the entire government went on alert. And, you know, the CIA counterterrorist group had, you know, with the authorization of the director, blew through 9 months of its budget in 15 days. You had every single embassy on high alert. You had every single asset of the CIA and the FBI and the Coast Guard and the rest working on this. You had customs brought in. You had, you know, it was virtually unprecedented. And they stopped terrorist attacks. They were coming. They stopped them around the world. There were some in Indonesia. There were some in Pakistan. There were some, and you just go down the list, and there was one in the United States. And the problem with that event, in a sort of a twisted way, is that it worked. And so people don't remember the Millennium attacks that never happened. And so when you hear, well, Bush had all this information, and one response is he could have stopped 9/11, which, I don't know that we can say that. And the other is, well, what could he have done? And the answer to the second question is he could have done what we've already seen worked. He could have put the government on high alert, but he didn't. And, you know, if you go back to that time, what were they spending their time on? They were talking about China. They were spending time on Russia. They were spending time on, of course, Iraq. And, you know, ultimately, they were returning to the old style foreign policy of, you know, national security is about other countries. And you know, the Republicans had been out of office for 8 years. And during that time, the whole concept of what's called transnational threats, meaning organizations that are not linked to any particular country but present a national security threat, developed from 92 to 2001. And they just weren't on board with understanding the changed nature of the national security circumstances faced by the United States.
Well, Condoleezza Rice was selling Star Wars as the panacea. That was her main national security focus. Ashcroft had put terrorism at the bottom of the threat list for the FBI. And as you've pointed out in your article in the New York Times, Kurt Eichenwald, The Deafness Before the Storm, it was the neocons in the Pentagon who told the White House that the CIA had been fooled and that bin Laden was merely pretending to be planning an attack to distract the administration from Saddam Hussein, which was their obsession. So, again, I just wish some of these people had been held to account. I mean, the neocons have never been held to account for the disaster that Iraq was and the extent to which Iran was the winner of the Iraq War. Again, you know, I mean, I'm not suggesting that you can make an ironclad case that Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Rice and company could be put on trial. But if you combine all the evidence that you've brought to the table from this recent CIA briefs that have not been declassified, and then their attitude towards Clinton, who was desperately trying to warn them, and, you know, the old adage, I understand, was ABC, anything but Clinton. They just simply ignored it because it came from Clinton. There's a whole history here of kind of arrogance that is breathtaking.
It was. And, I mean, the furthest I would go with all this, and it's the word I used in the piece, and it was a very much discussed word as to what the right word is. The word was negligence. The Bush administration in 2001 acted with severe negligence. And, I don't have to explain the reason why, because you just named it. It was arrogance. It was an arrogance that nobody had anything to say that was worth hearing if it wasn't what they already believed. And, like I said, there's no way to know if 9/11 could have been stopped or would have been stopped if we had done what we should have done. But the probabilities that it would have stopped or that it would not have happened are certainly higher had we done something rather than had we done nothing.
Again, I'm speaking with Kurt Eichenwald, who's a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and a New York Times bestselling author. He previously worked as a reporter at the New York Times for more than 20 years and is a two-time winner of the George Polk Award for Excellence in Journalism and was a Pulitzer Prize finalist in 2000 and 2010. His latest book just out is 500 Days, Secrets and Lies in the Terror Wars, and he has an article at the New York Times, The Deafness Before the Storm. So let's turn to the book and it is such a tragedy that this 9/11 happened on George Bush's watch, in as much as it brought out kind of the worst. I mean, I don't think we could have had a worse president. I mean, all those people, for example, on the left who say back in 2000 there was no difference between Bush and Gore, well, in retrospect, there had to be a huge difference. I don't think we would have had an Iraq war. We certainly would have had 9/11, probably, according to what we've just discussed, but maybe we wouldn't. We don't know that.
But it's the old thing, if things were different, would they have been the same? There's
exactly.
No way to know.
There's no way to know, but I think there's no question that we were wrong-footed from day one. I mean, here you had an attack in the heart of New York, where the international community is headquartered at the United Nations, and the first thing Bush did was go it alone. When the entire world had enormous sympathy to the United States, he just gave them the back of his hand.
Well, I wouldn't say from day one things were completely done incorrectly. I think they did do some things that were smart, but they were distracted from day one. Iraq came to the fore, and it was, you know, we really need to be dealing with Iraq. Iraq is involved in this. And it was, you know, assertions looking for fact to back them up, and there was none. It was ridiculous on its face. I mean, you had people there did not know or remember, or probably did not know, I would stick with that, that bin Laden declared war on Saddam Hussein in 1990. They didn't understand that Saddam was a secularist, and that bin Laden, and in particular Zawahiri, his second in command, was dedicated to the overthrow of secularist governments in the Middle East, and instead bringing in fundamentalist governments. You know, so the idea that these two were working together was ridiculous from the get-go, and it was very hard for the intelligence people to deal with that, because it would be as if I said, you know, when I walk home, I'm walking on the roof. And you could sit there and marshal as much evidence as you want that it's not true, but it's like, no, I'm walking on the roof. And if you have people who want to believe something, you can't change their minds. And that served to be a very damaging distraction. And on top of that, you know, it led us into a war that we never should have been in. The intelligence to support the whole weapons of mass destruction idea, flawed is the nice term, I will say, wasn't there. And, you know, it was only there if you sliced it and diced it and picked and chose, you know, what you wanted to prove. And using that standard, you could prove that water cures cancer. You know, and in the end, that was the key to the recklessness, the things that went really, really badly. You know, the soldiers are great. The soldiers are the most impressive people you'll ever meet. And they hate the Pentagon. The Pentagon made unbelievable number of mistakes in all of this, and holds a far higher level of responsibility for many things that went wrong than I think is generally understood.
So when you talk about the Pentagon, Kirk Aichmoller, you're also talking about Rumsfeld, are you not?
Rumsfeld, second in command, Wolfowitz.
The guy that on day one, when the plane finally landed, Air Force One, when they finally had their first meeting after 9/11 at Camp David, said it was all about Iraq, right?
It was all about Iraq. You had another guy, Douglas Feith, and one of the things that is in 500 Days that, you know, one of these mouth-dropping moments, and I think this speaks enormously to what was going on there. Douglas Feith, very high guy in the Pentagon, writes a memo in the earliest days after 9/11, before we've gone into Afghanistan, before we've really done anything, and his suggestion is that we should strike not Afghanistan, not Iraq, but a country in Latin America, and with the idea being, we have declared war on terrorism, and if we did this, we would surprise terrorists everywhere. Well, yeah, we'd also surprise them if we bombed Detroit, you know. And the idea that you'd go into a country that had nothing to do with anything sort of shows how far askew the thinking on some of this stuff was. And so, you know, these people were unfit for the offices they held. In fact, one of the scenes that's laid out that I think is really very powerful in the book is the highest levels of the British government. Tony Blair is meeting with his intelligence staff and his military staff, and they're sitting there talking about how Rumsfeld's incompetent. He's keeping information not only from people who needed to know, but also from the president. They had their own sort of spy in the circumstances, and knew that that the people in the Pentagon were not acting in the interest of the White House, and they were greatly distressed that Bush was going to be making decisions that they feared were going to be based on partially fed information that wasn't accurate.
Well, because these clowns in the Pentagon, their whole Iraq plan was based upon their chosen and anointed Chalabi, who all along was working for the Iranians. I mean, it's breathtaking when you catalog some of the stuff in your new book, Kurt Uckermall, 500 Days, Secrets and Lies in the Terror Wars. You know, you really are getting a picture here of the gang that couldn't shoot straight. President Bush mistakenly issued an unplanned international policy announcement during a critical speech at the United Nations because his staff loaded the wrong speech into the teleprompter. You mentioned the Tony Blair stuff. Also, Bush's phone call to Chirac of France, trying to get him to join in the war, where he tells Chirac that the Iraq war was willed by God and had been foretold in biblical prophecy. Then, of course, the famous anthrax attacks that involved Bruce Ivins, who took the FBI forever to find because he was working with the FBI. And nobody bothered to look at a psych evaluation that the guy was nuts. I mean,
right. I mean, yeah, when you start to lay out all the things that happen, somebody said that the book reads like a thriller, but if it was fiction, no one would believe it. And it's true. There were things, you know, the full story of 9/11 and the events that took place afterwards have not been known up until now. And the magnitude of what happened and some of the horrific mistakes that happened, it's also some of the very smart things that were done, are the catalog is very long. And, you know, I think because people have been very sensitive about, you know, the emotional scar of 9/11. There really hasn't been a full depiction of what we did and how we handled it. And in fact, you know, right off the bat, the book came out and people were saying, oh, it's, you know, unfortunately, it was all conservatives were saying how insensitive it was to have a book like this. And it's ridiculous. It's like, you know, it's like saying in 1956 we couldn't write a history of Pearl Harbor. This has to be known. People have to understand what happened. And we have to understand what happened because that is the essence of how we protect ourselves in the future.
Well, Kurt Uckermall, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Kurt Uckermall. He's a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and a New York Times bestselling author. He previously worked as a reporter at the New York Times for more than 20 years and is a two-time winner of the George Polk Award for Excellence in Journalism and was a Pulitzer Prize finalist in 2000 and 2002. His second book, The Informant, was made into a major motion picture starring Matt Damon, and his latest book just out is 500 Days, Secrets and Lies in the Terror Wars. He also has an article at the New York Times, The Deafness Before the Storm. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Quiet voice.